It's definitely haircut. The fact that I'm just going straight up the sides. Right. So this came out of a poor COVID move of I had like the little danglies over my glasses, which I think look somewhere between a observant Jewish person and a weird side mullet.
Friday, and we are drunk and retired.
And neither one's appropriate for me. Therefore, I did the natural thing of taking some clippers and trying to do it myself. And I messed up. And then I needed to get a haircut that was shorter than I expected. Pro moves. Welcome to COVID.
Yep. Welcome to COVID.
All right, so I want to kick this off because I want to kick this off with a very simple question, because Broberg, you just got up and walked away from the mic, and I got to admit, I wanted to see if you were wearing pants or not. let's take a poll. Who wears real pants still, or are we all have gotten to the point where we're wearing like what is it, the fleece pants or like basketball shorts? Gentlemen.
Dude, I haven't worn real pants for years.
All right. That's
I mean, like, that was a key part of Paul's career, right? Was the avoidance of hard pants. Yeah. Okay. And I do think we need to specify this, the difference between hard pants and soft pants here.
Yes.
Agreed. So I've been team soft pants for sure. I put on jeans exactly once. They did not fit how they once did. I took them off. I put back on my kind of fancy joggers. And that makes me feel less like a gremlin, but definitely like I'm working from home.
Yeah, well, they've got those like...
JNCOs?
I don't know what you'd call them, like the professional joggers. Like the commuter pants that are kind of somewhere between like work pants and also sort of comfy like pants. And so I've been wearing those for a couple of years anyway, for like travel and stuff.
So yeah, it seems legit to me.
I really haven't worn regular pants in years.
As a Texan, I have to wear jeans. As a Texan, I have to wear jeans, but I haven't worn jeans for over, I tweeted about this. Like I actually looked at the time and it was 134 days before I wore some jeans to go to a school opening relatively recently. And I've gotten to the point now where I'm just wearing the fleece pants when I'm working because I just don't care anymore. People only ever see me from my chest up anyway. So, you know, I know no one listens to our podcast anyway. So, hey, there we go. When you know I'm presenting and now you know that I'm just wearing those. What are they called? The fleece pants or like pajama? They're not pajama pants. That's not the right term for it. You know what I'm talking about? Like the house pants?
Sweat. Pants?
No. The sweatpants have like elastic around
like
them.
Like loungewear.
Those are joggers.
Those are joggers.
Joggers are fancy sweatpants that strangle your ankles like very weak hands. Like, yeah.
Always like them as like fleece. Oh. Okay. So I'm thinking of like the fleece. I'm wearing basketball shorts right now, but I would have shown you otherwise.
That's
but
my ultimate I'm done with today. If I've got basketball shorts on, all bets are off. This will not be a productive day. Like you're just lucky I'm here.
you're lucky I'm wearing my glasses and I can actually see you.
Yeah, you're
now,
welcome.
Here's the real question that we're all dying to know the answer to. Has No Undy Monday stretched all the way to be no underwear the entire week?
Oh.
Ooh, no.
Because like Monday used to be that special occasion where you'd be like, no Undy Monday.
In whose book?
It's got to be an Australian thing. I've never heard this before.
Never heard no Undy Monday? Monday?
God,
must
no.
Be an Australian no Undy Monday.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Well, anyway, I guess, hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey.
that was one hell of a way to start a podcast, I guess. So.
Yeah, I'm into it.
Yeah. Oh, And I will say this in the recording, because we're already recording. I did find the lost episode. So we have a lost episode that will appear on our feed soon. Being like, it just shows up and it's completely out of context and it's going to be amazing. So
we're probably going to be super time specific and be talking about a very specific conference or something.
Exactly.
And it's going to make no sense whatsoever.
No sense at all.
And that's on brand.
Yeah. So that's all right.
Very nice.
Cool. So what are we talking about today, gentlemen, other than pants?
Well, I feel like there's an elephant in the room and I want to clear this up. A few days ago, I saw young Matthew posting a Twitter photo of making chicken wings. And he had made the rookie error of using baking soda instead of baking powder.
But can we just really revel in the pride I had that I was repeating this, you know, sacred process of making delicious chicken wings as taught by my one and only guru, Paul. And the poor guy has to text me. He's like, those are going to taste terrible. Because baking soda and baking powder are in fact not the same.
Right. So for those who don't know, baking soda is very much like JJ in that it's basic.
Aww.
And if you've ever done
bitter. In that way, it makes them bitter.
Yeah, if you've ever done the baking soda and vinegar trick, right, where it bubbles up.
Well, that's what the old volcanoes. Yeah, you put dye in it.
Of course.
Yeah, right. And so basically baking soda works by leavening whatever it is, by having that reaction between acid and itself and creating the bubbles. So most recipes that want baking soda have some sort of acidic compound as well, right? Whereas baking powder is baking soda plus an acidic powder as well. And so when you add water, the two combine and you get your leavening immediately. And then, the basic things tend to be bitter. And so with baking powder, the acid then kind of offsets that and brings it back to be neutral. Whereas baking powder on its own is quite bitter, which is why if you put a little bit too much baking powder into your biscuits or you don't use buttermilk, you get like a super bitter taste to your biscuits.
I had no idea.
Yeah. And then the good baking powders are double acting. So they act once with liquid and then they act a second time with heat, which is why often a baking powder recipe, you can't pre-mix the batter because it's double acting. And so if you use it too soon and leave it,
you'll miss out on the
sort of disappear.
So in that contrast, what I should have used, baking powder is the one I should have used, not the baking soda. Yeah.
And so basically the baking powder will react with the water in the chicken skin and create the bubbles like just slightly under the skin and give you that really
crispy as hell chicken.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, I can tell you the result. If you ever find yourself in an incredibly idiotic situation with chicken wings, I've also learned you can throw them into water, put some ice in there, let them soak, and basically get the dirty stuff you put on top out of it for about 20 minutes. And I took them out, dried them off, and reseasoned them, and they ended up tasting great. They weren't nearly as crispy as intended because they didn't get the time to do that like I intended, but they turned out, they tasted great, which was, you know, one of the challenges.
Did you use the Google to figure out how to do that? Or how did you figure out how to clean your wings there?
I used the Zerkaus Google. It's very, very similar. It's texting this guy until you get answers because you're like, dear God, help me.
What did I do?
So there's actually, JJ, I was telling Matt this, but there are some Chinese recipes that tell you to use baking soda in like a marinade with meat. Mm. And then you kind of wash that off. Often it's part of what they'll call velveting the meat. And it sort of modifies the texture of the meat and makes it a bit more tender. Mm-hmm. And one of the, I guess the basicness of the baking soda helps to break it down. And then of course you then wash it off. And so one of the things when you're doing that is you need to make sure it's very lean meat, because it will kind of get stuck in and create bad flavors with any like fatty pieces. Because I guess it's more soluble in fat than it is not.
Okay.
It was a great life lesson. I don't know if I learned as much as I meant to. I definitely learned a ton of tricks that day. Yeah, that sucked. Thanks for the catch.
Well, on the flip side, CZ and I had a massive win recently when it came to cooking some meat.
Oh, tell me about it.
Yes. So, okay. Take a quick step back. When you think of really good steak or think of really good cuts of meat, Robert, what comes to your mind?
Ribeye, filet mignon.
Okay. All right. So tender, usually pretty fatty, like has a lot of good flavor to it. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, ribeye is my happy place these days for sure. Because I am very into the liquefying of that fat and
Where does New York strip fit in that realm in your mind?
It's really good. I'll be honest and say like, I don't know enough to differentiate. I think it's like it tastes pretty good, but it doesn't seem to be quite as, you know, velvety. Can I use that word now? But no.
Sure. Lazy JJ, it basically says the fat cap is on the top for a New York strip. 9 out of 10 times, that's how you determine the type.
Oh, okay.
Right? Like you have, and if you look at where the cut is for filet mignon or beef tenderloin and New York strip, they're actually part of that T-bone thing right there. And there's a whole narrative around that, and I'm not going to get into that right now. But what I'm focusing on is that fat cap.
Okay.
So CZ and gave me a huge surprise and present by finding some picanha here in town, and he was like, "Hey JJ, I found it," and I'm like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" He's like, "I found the picanha," and I'm like, "So you went to like normally you find this specific cut of meat is usually found at Argentinian steakhouses where it's that little C. There's a C and there's a big fat cap on top of it, and you slice off bits of it. So you have like a fat cap and like a really thin piece of meat attached to it. So if you're a fan of fat like I am, it's just fucking heaven. Like that's the only word for it. I even just go to Estancia's, our local Brazilian steakhouse. I'm sorry. I specifically go there just to have this cut of meat.
Nice.
Now going to a Brazilian steakhouse, you're going to drop quite a bit of money. It's a known fact. CZ found the cut of meat the whole reason why I go to the Brazilian steakhouse for fractions of how much I would spend at the Brazilian steakhouse in our local grocery store. He's like, "Oh, by the way, I found it right here." And I'm like, what? So we got on his rotisserie. He cut up the steaks. If you've seen on his Instagram, and we put it on it and did the little spinny thing, and we had the drips of meat going. It was, I had dreams about it for days afterwards. You think I'm kidding? I'm not. I really did dream about it.
No, I mean I dreamt about it. I didn't even eat it. I just saw some Instagramming. Yeah. But Paul, talk us through it. Like, why is that magic, and how does one know to hunt this down?
I mean, I just know to hunt it down because it's delicious at the Brazilian steakhouse. It's not a super common cut here in the US, and it's regularly called other things. So often you'll see it as a top sirloin cap or a culotte.
I didn't know that culotte one.
It has, like, more recently, as Brazilian steakhouses has become more common, it's become better known as picanha. And it's because it's not super common here, the cut that makes up the picanha is usually like split up into like the rump and the round and the loin. Mm. And so it's not even often kept whole. But then, so usually like you have to kind of custom request it at like a good butcher. But I guess it's just becoming popular enough that even the grocery stores now are starting to carry it. Now it was a choice, and usually because, you know, I'm kind of bougie, I guess I wouldn't usually stoop to choice meat. but you know, there's nothing wrong with choice. I'm just a little bit picky. And so, yeah, you get it as, well, we got it as the whole muscle. And so we cut it into, I think, 5 or 6 steaks that were pretty thick, like a couple of inches thick. And then kind of you fold them, as JJ said, in like a U shape. If you're a pro, you can just like fold and stick it on the skewer. But we actually tied them in shape and then skewered them. And I think that's because we had a rotisserie skewer, so it was quite thick versus like one of those like thin sword like ones that you can just like slide on through easy. So we went for the make sure it stays intact method of tying it first and then skewering it. And then we just stuck it on the rotisserie. I've got a custom built rotisserie / grill that a friend of mine built for me. And so we stuck it on that, fired up some charcoal, and it was cooked in no time at all. Like, I think we barely had time for a beer.
Yeah.
And then while it was cooking, I also grilled up some corn and some jalapenos, and I also blackened some green onions. Like usually with, what's the green sauce, JJ, you'd usually have with it?
Chimichurri.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So usually you'd have that, which is basically some herbs, some garlic, some oil, some lemon or lime. So kind of like a vinaigrette that's heavily herbed. I didn't think far enough ahead to have any of the herbs you'd use. So I went for the charred green onions and the charred jalapenos, and then oil, lemon, a little bit of vinegar, some crushed garlic. And it was pretty delicious.
I have to ask again, because I never can seem to remember this. Scallions and green onions are the same fucking thing, right?
They're more or less interchangeable.
Okay.
So I think scallions are long and thin the whole length, whereas green onions usually have like a little bulb at the bottom.
Okay.
But for the most part,
you can use them interchangeably, right? Are they the same plant, just different levels of maturity?
Well, I think the green onion is the same plant as a regular onion, just different levels of maturity. Whereas I think the green onion is, what was the other one?
Scallion.
The scallion is a slightly different variety of onion. They're all part of the allium or alum family.
Also, it's not garlic. A scallop. It's not a scallop. Make sure you don't realize that you're trying to look for scallions and you get a bunch of scallops because you think they're the same thing and your parents look like you're crazy. Not that that's happened to me before.
That would be shellfish of you if you did got the wrong.
It's good. It's good, man.
You left it out there. I'm into it. So what in the technology landscape is going on with your mind since we're getting to the back half of this? Well, yeah. I thought this podcast covers both meat and news.
I guess. So let me talk about... I've been having issues with my laptop. It's like 4 years old and like it's good, but it's just not coping with anything that would like to have a decent GPU. So like Zoom, tons of stuff you'd see in Chrome, like YouTube and stuff like that. And other stuff, and like OBS and all this stuff that we're doing now. So I've been.
This is your personal machine?
And
this is your personal machine?
No, this is my work machine.
Oh.
And so I've been trying to get a new work machine, and I'm having long discussions with IT because I have particular needs that aren't necessarily being taken care of by a random standard like build of a Dell laptop.
It's just Dell. It's a Dell laptop with Windows 10 on it. You can choose either gray or black.
Right.
And what version of Office?
In the meantime, I've been trying to figure out how I can get by. And so I bought an external GPU. So it's like a external box that you put a regular like NVIDIA card in, and it plugs in via Thunderbolt or USB-C or whatever that socket is. And it works pretty well, but some things just don't like using it on Linux. And one of the things I discovered was that Chrome on Linux does not use GPU for things like decoding like H.264 YouTube videos and stuff. Really? But there is a patched version of Chromium that does. And so I went on a little bend this morning because it was time to do some updates on my machine anyway, of installing Chromium with that patch, but also installing VS Codeium, which is the open source. Well, I mean, VS Code is open source, but it's packed.
No, it's not. Technically, it is not.
It's built from open source, right?
The package that you download, is not.
That's what I'm getting to. The package you download is not open source, and it contains some proprietary stuff, including some things that report back to Microsoft about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So there is VS Codeium, which is the source packaged up and made available without the extra proprietary Microsoft spyware. Mm-hmm. And so I figured I would give that a shot at the same time. And so I installed both of those this morning. Unfortunately, Chromium does not play YouTube videos at all right now for me. So I need to figure through that out. But so far, VS Codeium has just been like a drop-in replacement.
Very interesting. First of all,
you shouldn't be watching YouTube during the day. You should be doing your job.
What?
What?
Did you? What happened? Are you the worst manager? What are you talking about? Like, his job is YouTube. Next to the conspiracies and the food videos, there is a lot of good technology there. But I only make that very specific point and ruin your punchline, Paul, because I was exploring this in a lot of detail on opensource.com because we were getting some commentaries to not write about VS Code because it's not open source. I'm like, that seems absurd. So looking at it, I'm like, source code, the repo's right there, the license is definitely approved by the OSI. And it got to this point of realizing like there is a valid point to these source code available with an open source license, but like a proprietary backend or packaging system. Mm-hmm. That is a differentiated category and is helpful to acknowledge for those that are truly, I'd say, like really all in on making sure everything they touch is open source, which I value people that believe in that principle. And then I also am someone who comes from like a community background where I really appreciate that people maintain this code, and I don't mind giving them information about my usage as a exchange for excellent code. But that is my value proposition there. So I don't say it's not open source as a burn. I say it as an acknowledgement of like the free and open source movement will be passionately opposed to it for some degree. But I think what's cool is that people care about it. They made VS Codeium as an alternative, and it uses the same packages and everything.
So I've got a muddied line in my head because
you're exactly where you need to be.
Nice. Cause there's also the VS Code. I'm just saying VS Code is a catch-all. I don't know the specific lineage here. There's a VS Code that's open, quote unquote, open sourced that you can run on a server that you can connect to that you don't run locally. It just runs the same exact code that upstream VS Code runs. That's what all like that code ready workspaces from Red Hat is built off of. Oh, the Quay, not Quay, Che, C-H-E is another one of them. They're all like... So
my understanding, JJ, is that VS Code is an Electron app.
Okay.
Or it is one of those like, it's actually really a website but packaged as an app. And so therefore it wasn't, finger quote, too difficult for people to repackage from the source a web version of it.
Got it. Then that lineage is kind of come together.
Yeah.
That was the leap I hadn't made about the Electron app. Thank you.
Yeah. Now I've heard people make distinctions between VS Code, the text editor, and Visual Studio, the IDE.
Mm.
And that technically VS Code is not an IDE, a text editor. I am not that deep into caring about such distinctions. But the people that are, and Visual Studio is not open source.
Yes.
But I think VS Code was inspired by Visual Studio.
Exactly.
I would almost say influenced, not like inspired. Like we should do this like this. It was like this was the UX that people have in this world, and it became a de facto standard now that.
Yeah. So honestly, VS Code is like Kubernetes and Borg, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great. Actually, that's a really good analogy. That's a really good analogy. And also, like majority of like beginner developers, like who are coming into our industry, that's how they're interfacing with code now is through VS Code, because that whole soup to nuts narrative of you download VS Code, you get an account on GitHub, congratulations, you can now functionally develop on almost every single major platform.
Right. And the other thing that's cool is, I think it did predate VS Code, but it's why VS Code was so doable. There's like an accepted standard way to write extensions and stuff for IDEs.
Oh.
And so if you're using like Eclipse or you're using VS Code, in theory, the same extension will work on both.
Really? Eclipse and VS Code? Really?
Yeah. So if you're writing like a text highlighter for Kotlin and you do it in this format, that text highlighter will work on both.
Wow.
I don't know the exact details and specifics, but I have friends that are very, very into the features and capabilities of IDEs and comparing them. And they are more than happy to expound the differences and why this is such a big deal.
I want to make sure this is also known that there are IBM plugins or VS Code for Z Linux and COBOL in case you needed to use that.
Cool. But
I didn't hear crickets. At least I didn't hear crickets. Yeah.
Now, one thing I discovered that I found very amusing during my 2-year-long vacation at IBM was that Lotus Notes is actually, like the user interface is built off of Eclipse.
No, really?
So occasionally it would crash and give you an Eclipse error.
Wow. I mean, it makes sense, right? Like,
make sense, but.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. That is crazy.
And what was your experience on the browser side? I fiddle between, sounds like you have to do some troubleshooting just to get YouTube running. So I don't know if I'd call Chromium a win for you yet, but for what it's worth, I've run Chromium, you know, vanilla Chrome, and Brave next to each other for a while. All three are based on Chromium and it's been pretty solid. I tend to stick to Brave because they're so good at clearing all the crap out, like all the ad blocking built in. It's really smooth. Occasionally something that redirects you a bunch, it will block. So you need to use a different browser for it. So I'll swap between. But yeah, I like that space. What's your experience so far, Paul?
So I have used Chromium on and off as well, but just on my current iteration of my machine, I just had like Chrome and Firefox, and kind of my general distinction was that Chrome was for real work and then Firefox was for like random testing of things that required regular clearing of cookies and stuff like that. But between recent changes with the team that developed Firefox and also my performance issues, I thought it would be a good time to try and find some other way to eke some life out of my current laptop. I didn't think about Brave, so I'm going to have to look and see what Brave's CPU support is like.
Can we take an aside and talk about Brave for a moment? Because I've sort of seen people pop up and use it in different places, like when screen sharing and things like that. And I've never actually, I had a situational awareness of it, but I've never really dug into it. Apart from like making the internet better with taking all the crap out of it, Broberg, what else draws you to Brave, or is it just, that just it?
A pretty cool logo. No, I do like its lion logo. It's kind of neat. I'm into Brave for exactly what you said. They have a very opinionated view of what needs to happen on the internet going forward, and they are very, I'd say, the free software side of the open source free software movement. So pretty dead focused on that. There's a little bit of, and they're experimenting with incentive systems. Like if you want advertisements, if people want to give you advertisements, then they have to share the profit with you through a cryptocurrency. You know, that's an opt-in feature that you can use. But primarily it's just like an excellent default browser and ad blocker that doesn't make my CPU go wild. No matter which extension I choose in Chrome, it seems to at some point just peg a CPU, uBlock or any of the others. And I've just found it's been really consistent. And it even loads faster. I don't know exactly how. This is my naive understanding of it, but it's been pretty smooth and pretty fast.
So right now
we're going to do a test here. While you were talking, I installed Brave. I'm going to load up YouTube. I'm going to play a video and we're going to see if the Zoom goes all the hell.
That sounds good to me, Paul.
Well, I'm already pegged at 4 GPUs at 99, CPUs at 99%. So that's not a good start.
Not a good start.
So I'm the type of person I use Firefox.
Most of that is Slack and Zoom. Oh.
Yeah,
he's Robot Paul, delay. Can you mute until your CPU doesn't bomb out?
He's even gotten a delay on the Zoom now. That's not good.
What were you saying, JJ?
Yeah, I'm the type of person, I try to have compartmentalized. Thank you. I try to do that with like everything in Firefox I do for work, and then Chrome I do for personal. So I'm actually going to, and so when I have either browser up, I'm like, oh, if I can, you know, do personal stuff on this one. So I'm actually going to try, I downloaded Brave myself as we were talking about this, because you've inspired me to at least give this the college try. And I'm going to use that for specifically work is what I've chosen to do, because I have so many like Chrome plugins and crap like that for all like my G Suite stuff.
That's the other thing that's super nice about it. When you import from Chrome, it also imports your plugins. So it's just like, it's a one-to-one switch over. I swapped from Chrome to that and I still use Firefox for personal. I know they're going through a lot of change and I'm sad to see how many people were laid off, but I'm still kind of on board with their mission at Mozilla. And if I have to use a browser to help, then I'll do that until things get better.
Seems reasonable.
All right. My experiment didn't go so well. I think you
did
noticed.
Not sound good.
No, really good.
I think I'm back to usable.
Yeah, you sound great again.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, the more you know. Keep looking, Paul. What are you thinking hardware wise?
I really like the look of the new Dell XPS 15s, this year's model.
They're very pretty. I've been
given a flat out no, but there is a new version of the Dell like T5500, I think it's Latitude, that looks good enough, but it's kind of in that, oh, we'll have it ready for people to use in 2 weeks. And of course that 2 weeks is always 2 weeks away. Mm-hmm. So I'm about ready to give up and just try to see if I can just buy one and expense it or do something.
It's a geographical anomaly, 2 weeks from everywhere. Name that movie. Nope, we're good. We'll just move it along. It's a little Easter egg for people.
Speaking of movie quotes, I dropped the what's in the box, right? Which is apt given the new one's coming out soon. And Bob thought I was making a reference to Seven.
Yeah, I would as well.
And I'm like, no, no, it's Dune.
I know, but Seven saw that one. Like,
it really did. It really did. It's oh, no, one password doesn't work with Brave. One pass?
Really?
Yeah. It's not working for me.
See, now, Matt, you've got JJ and I running off installing browsers when we're supposed to be podcasting.
Yeah,
I blame you, sir.
Is this podcasting or just weird tech support and meat sweat right? conversation?
Yeah, right.
Speaking of meat sweat, okay, so I've really only... What's the perfect thickness of a ribeye? Like, when your yes. ass...
The answer is yes.
Well, at some point it stops being a ribeye and just becomes a prime rib, right?
Yeah, that's
a good point. I truly don't know that, but I'm interested in hearing more.
So I think a prime rib is basically a roast made from uncut bone-in ribeyes.
Sounds right.
Right. And then the tomahawk steak is a bone-in ribeye with extra bone.
Yeah, they've taken off that cap to make it look like a tomahawk, but in essence, you want to eat that part anyway because
they don't take the cap off. They just use a longer part of the rib.
Oh, really?
Hence ribeye. So usually they cut it so that they can get like a full rack of ribs. Mm-hmm. But when you do the bone-in ribeyes, you're basically sacrificing the ribs to get the bone on the ribeye. Mm. Sorry, the tomahawk, not the bone-in ribeye. Yeah. And the boneless ribeye is just, you know, because so many people prefer meat without bones.
Their loss.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, there you go. And that didn't really answer my question, though. So if I could, would it be like 1 1/4, 1.5 inch, 2 inches?
Yeah, I think like 1.5 inches. Like something you can get a really good sear on the outside without overcooking the inside. Which, unless you have like super high heat charcoal or something, can be a challenge. Because ideally you want like the entire surface of the steak to be like brown, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not that uncommon on a thinner steak to get like gray with like a couple of brown bits. Because you just can't get high enough heat to really crust up the outside without overcooking the inside.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And that's where you can use different cooking techniques, like the reverse sear. Although you need a thick steak for reverse sear, so maybe that's not a good example. Sous vide, I guess, is a good example where you can cook it sous vide to the perfect temperature. You can then chill it again. And then you can just cook the outside and it browns up much quicker because you've already mm-hmm. pulled most of the surface moisture off the steak, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's the now patented just keep flipping method, which also helps because it gives each side like a rest between applying the high heat to it. So you can actually cook it for a little bit longer than if you were to just do like once on either side without overcooking it, because every time you put cook side up, that side starts to cool again.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So thin steaks, just keep flipping. Thicker steaks, reverse sear or whatever. It's kind of your go-to. But I think to avoid that whole set of questions, just make sure it's a good inch and a half and mm-hmm. you're good for the reverse sear or just like the one flip and done or the keep flipping. Like it all works if it's thick enough.
And you're encouraged to practice many, many times. So you eat a lot of steak.
Yeah. And actually I was going to mention this with the picanha, but mm-hmm. like in the Brazilian steakhouse, they have those like sword skewers that go on the rotisserie.
Mm-hmm.
At home, you can do them on a rotisserie. But if you don't have a rotisserie, you can just cook them like a regular steak. Like you still like curl them up on themselves and you just keep flipping. And if you do it thick enough, which you should also be able to stand it up on the two sides.
Oh, yeah.
And so you can just basically like maybe like 30 seconds, flip 90 degrees, 30 seconds, flip 90 degrees and just kind of essentially create like a very manual rotisserie that mm-hmm. just flips every 30 seconds and you'll still end up with a very good steak.
Best steak is the one in front of you.
Oh yeah.
Awesome. Well, I mean, got anything else to say? I mean, I felt like that was a pretty good ending right there. Like kind of summed up the whole episode right there. No,
I feel like we should have talked about more tech stuff, but I'm also not that bothered by
Really.
Hey, did we'll you JJ have decide. A question about simmering versus boiling?
I did, and maybe we can hold this for the next one because I'm going to be doing some more gumbo soon, and it'd be nice to have another experience with gumbo, so then I can come back and be like, okay. The fuck is a simmer? Because I really, really still don't know what the difference is between simmering something, boiling something. Well, I know the difference between boiling and rolling boil, but the boiling spectrum is really, really large. And when does simmering actually start? And when is it pre-boiling to become a simmer, to become boiling? Like there's, I'm an engineer at heart. I look for very consistent things. And I can't seem to zero in on when something is quote unquote simmering.
Right.
Not that I'm passionate about this or anything.
I guess next week we'll have that conversation.
Sounds good.
Your job, JJ, is to research it and tell us next week what it is. And then we will tell you if you're correct or not.
Why can't I just assume you're going to say that I'm wrong anyway and just tell me the right answer?
But isn't that part of the fun of learning from Paul?
That's right.
Baking soda.
I don't feel like I've taught you if I haven't first had an opportunity to tell you you're an idiot.